We come now to the second passage in the book of Romans, as we began last Sunday. We picked up where we pick up where we left off in verse 8, down to verse 15. Congregation, God's holy word, please give it your attention, not only the reading, but the preaching of his word. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is proclaimed in all the world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I mention you always in my prayers, asking that somehow by God's will I may now at last succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you, that is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I want you to know, brothers, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you as well as among the rest of the Gentiles. I am under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. Congregation, in a sense, we are still in the introduction section of the book of Romans before Paul addresses the theological issues that he needs to address. He needs to address some personal issues. Obviously, some tension had arose between the Christians in Rome and the Apostle Paul. You see, he had never met them before. They had never met him. And yet he was their apostle. He's writing this book as their apostle. And yet for some strange reason to them, he had never been to Rome. The church was started by others. We read back in Acts 2 that some of the people that were there at Pentecost were from Rome. So likely very early on, they returned with the gospel. The church began and grew under them. Paul had never traveled in all his journeys to Rome. There was a very large church there now, large group of Christians. And the question comes up not only here, but at the end of the book, why hasn't Paul ever visited them if he is their apostle? Does he not care about them? Is he biased against the Romans for some reason, the Roman Christians? Is he afraid? Is he afraid to come to Rome because of the persecution there? Is he afraid because he's embarrassed or ashamed of the gospel that he preaches? There is an open question of whether we can trust Paul and whether we should receive and accept that he is our apostle, though we've never met him. So Paul needs to deal with this sort of open question before he begins both explaining correct theology as well as Christian living. So he must assure them that he's always wanted to visit them, that they are on his mind. He is their apostle. He prays for them. And he has been prevented from coming. Now, you may have noted when I read this that Paul almost gushes in his praise of them as well as the way he words his desire to be there. Think of how this comes out. I thank God for all of you. I pray for you unceasingly. I've been wanting to come to you for years. I want to be encouraged by you because your faith is talked about through all the world. Now, if you didn't know any better, you would think Paul's being a bit of a salesman here. He's overdoing it in his praise of them. But what I want you to see is that Paul means every word. And you're going to see why this is important in a moment. So he begins to assure them that he does thank God for them. They are on his mind often. I thank my God through Jesus Christ. Here we have theology through the gospel, through the work of Christ. We can call God our God or my God. This would have been strange language for the average Old Testament believer. And yet Paul says, through Christ, he is my God, just like yours. But I thank God all the time for you. And the reason he gives is that your faith is being proclaimed through the whole world. Now, what he means by that is people in those days could travel to and from Rome often. People did business in Rome, and then they came to these other cities. So Christians would come back and say, Paul, I've been to the church there, and when I worship with them, they're doing well in the midst of a place like Rome where there's a lot of pressure. We see what Paul means in chapter 16 when he writes, your obedience is known to all. By faith here, then, he means your obedience, your faithfulness. That you have a reputation when people come visit you, then they come back to Greece where I am and they tell me about what you're like. People talk about you in other places I've been. It's known throughout the civilized world there. And so they heard in the midst of Jewish persecution, there would be economic pressure that if you wanted to get ahead, you would have to pinch some incense to the Roman emperor. They had refused to do that and were suffering economically. It was not easy to be a Christian in the city like Rome, and yet they were doing well. And so Paul is very thankful. Now notice that Paul thanks God for their faith. He doesn't thank the evangelists who first brought the word to them. He doesn't thank them. He thanks the Lord. Faith is a gift of God, as Paul will write in Ephesians. Every good spiritual thing we have is from God, right? And so who is the proper one to thank for any spiritual good? Well, God. So Paul says, I hear about your faith, and I thank God unceasingly. Unceasingly, as we've talked about before, it just means it's just a pattern of his prayers. Once a week or once a day, he would think of the Romans, and he would thank God for them. And notice how he takes an oath here. He swears. He says, I swear to you that you're on my mind and I pray for you. And I swear that I long to be with you. Paul takes an oath, and that shows us that God does take oaths seriously. When you swear an oath to God at your baptism, you swear an oath to God when you get married, of how you will treat your husband or wife. You swear an oath when you become a member of a church. God takes those seriously, and so does the Apostle Paul. Paul assumes this will have some weight with them. He says, I swear I've taken an oath that what I'm telling you is the genuine truth. Now, later, he goes on to explain to them why he wants to come see them. And so he writes, I long to impart some spiritual gift to you. This doesn't refer to the spiritual gifts like in 1 Corinthians. They probably already were exercising those. He means he wants to help them grow, impart spiritual strength through his own teaching that they have not received personally. They could learn more about Christ and the Bible that they have learned. He would love to come and help them grow spiritually. But notice how he goes on, but I also would like to be blessed by you. I would like to be encouraged by your faith also. And so he wants it to be reciprocal, not just him being the one who teaches. He wants to learn from them. And you think about that for a moment, who this is coming from. Now in verse 15, he also writes, I want to preach the gospel to you. And I hope you don't pass that up too quickly. Isn't that a little odd? He wants to preach the gospel to who? To the Christians. But I thought only non-Christians needed the gospel preached to them. Is Paul making a mistake here? Does Paul mean, well, really, I want to preach the gospel to your non-Christian family members or friends? Well, that too, but that's not what he means here. You see, as Christians, you need the gospel each week to be preached to you. You need to hear the gospel over and over as much as unbelievers. So Paul says, I want to preach the gospel to you also. And that's a wonderful reminder of the centrality of the gospel in our lives. We never move beyond needing to hear the gospel. And Paul understands that. And then finally he says, I want to reap a harvest. I would love to see fruit from my ministry there in Rome with you. Of course, that raises the question, if you've wanted to be here so badly, why have you never been here all these years? And so in verses 13 and 14, he answers that question. It's not because I haven't wanted to. I've actually often made plans. Paul says that he's prayed to God, he's prayed to God that God would somehow open the doors that he'd be able to take a trip to Rome. But notice how he writes, God has thus prevented me from being able to come. He submits to the will of God, but what we see here is how often God says no to our plans. Paul prayed over and over, I really would like to do this, Lord. And yet the Lord in his providence would keep putting roadblocks in his way, other things he had to do. And so we do learn here that God often answers our prayers with no, ultimately for our good and his glory. But often we can pray for something we want, and God has a different plan or idea. And so Paul says, I've been praying for years for an opportunity to come visit you, and yet it just hasn't worked out. And yet Paul does not complain against God. He submits to God's providence. But in verse 14, he adds why he has been so busy that he hasn't been able to visit. And that is he's been preaching the gospel to other nations, to other cities and cultures. He's under obligation to preach both to the Greeks and barbarians. This was a way to say back then, both to the wise and the educated and the uneducated, or the people who live in the big modern cities and the people who live out in the boonies, as we would call it. Paul would go to both places. Now, in Rome, they would consider themselves the Greeks, which there meant the wise. He says, but both sides need the gospel. The educated and the uneducated are equally lost, both in the city and out in the country. And I've been busy starting churches and reaching people, preaching the gospel there. I haven't been able to come to Rome yet. Now, Paul will explain elsewhere that his ministry is not to build upon another man's foundation. So if somebody else had brought the gospel to an area and was already a church planter or an evangelist, he would not go also. He would go to places where there were no churches, and he would start churches. That was his ministry. And so that was another reason why Rome was not a priority, because someone else had already brought the gospel there. But he assures them that it's not because he lacks love for them. And it's not because he hasn't thought about them or prayed for them. And not because he lacks a desire or he's afraid of the criticism. He's been wanting to go and be their apostle in person, but he has not been able to. So in essence, Paul deals with what he knows is an underlying personal concern before he then moves on to the theme of the book, which we will look at next week. Now, what do we learn from this, the way Paul speaks here? Well, Paul is a representative of Christ. And I've reminded you often that too many times in modern Christianity, Paul is only a representative of what the best Christian should look like. So you always hear, be like Paul. But Paul often, given that he has been set apart to represent Christ, pictures not the best Christian necessarily, though there's some truth there, but he represents Christ himself. You see, what could Paul have done differently? What might you have done? Paul finds out that the Roman Christians doubted his authority. They weren't quite sure if he was the real thing, if he was genuine. How could Paul have approached this in a different manner? He could have said, don't you know, I have talked to Christ himself. You haven't. Matter of fact, Christ appeared to me and appointed me as your apostle. I have seen a vision of heaven. Have you? I have actually talked to the Lord more than once when he appeared to me. You see, in the ancient world, if you wanted to gain a hearing, if you wanted to gain prominence, you told about your experiences and how your experiences were more important or valuable. Paul could have asserted himself, but he didn't. Paul could have said, you need to understand, I am God's apostle and I'm coming to Rome. And when I come to Rome, I expect a large gathering to come bring me in, some kind of a red carpet. We don't they didn't use that term. I would like a very prominent seat in a large house, and I want all the Christians to make appointments to come see me. They can kneel down and kiss my ring. I am the vicar of Christ, after all, the representative of Christ. Paul doesn't do that, does he? He doesn't take the approach that most would have taken. Paul comes at it a totally different way. I long to see you. I want to be encouraged by you. I've been impressed with your reputation. I thank God for you. What does he remind us about Christ? Christ did not come to be served and demand respect. He came to serve because we needed him to lower himself and go to the cross for us. Paul is picturing what Christ is like, the one he represents, and not overasserting his authority and making demands. But he comes to them as a servant without asserting too much his authority. How can Paul be like this? How can he be so humble? Well, Paul realizes, like you and me, he's a sinner, right? Everything he's received, he hasn't deserved. It's been a free gift. He knows he's no better than those Roman Christians, or you, or me. And so Paul lowers himself for a different reason than Christ. Paul lowers himself because he's a sinner. Christ lowers himself out of love for us. So we do see an example of Christ here, but then Paul becomes an example to us, how we are to treat one another. First of all, we should thank God for other Christians, for one another. And I often remind you of this, but the greatest miracle on planet Earth is the Christian sitting next to you. There is no greater miracle than God taking a sinner and bringing them into the kingdom of God when they were dead in sin. There's no natural miracle that compares what God does to the soul when he saves a sinner. So Paul is able to say, I thank God for all of you, weak Christians, strong Christians. He understands what a miracle salvation is. It's interesting that Paul would rather fellowship with the humblest Christian in Rome than with Caesar, or with what we would say today, a star athlete, or an actor, or actress, or a president. Paul considers it a great privilege to be able to go to Rome, and half of these Christians were slaves, and sit with these lowly slaves, and be encouraged by them in hearing about their faith. Paul understands the gospel. And so we learn from Paul how to consider one another. Paul believed he could benefit. Often we write people off. We come to a conclusion about another Christian. Oh, I really couldn't learn much from them because they're too this. Well, they're too much like this. And we write them off. Paul doesn't write off any Christian. There's always something you can learn from every Christian. If somebody asked me, you know, my kids are getting into the teenage years, what do I do as a Christian parent? Besides saying I have no idea, which is what I usually say, I say, what I would recommend is talk to every parent in the church that has done it. Reject about 90% of what they say, and then glean a little bit from each one, because you can learn something from each one's perspective. There is something about the way they've lived or thought about something that you haven't, that you can learn. And that's what Paul views. Paul says, I could be with any Christian, and I could benefit from being around them and listening to them, whatever it is. We also learn from Paul this idea of obligation. Paul says something very strange here. He says, I'm obligated to the Greeks and barbarians. That's strange wording. Now, we would expect him to say, I'm obligated to God, but I have to preach the gospel. I can't come see you. I'm obligated to God to do what he's called me. But instead, he says, I'm obligated to these unbelievers. That raises the question, what does he owe them that he's obligated to them? Well, the answer is that God called him and gave him a responsibility, and he's given him the gift to preach the gospel, and he owes them to use that gift for their benefit. I want you to think about that as Christians, you are obligated. You owe unbelievers something. because God has given you a gift. Woe to Paul if he hoards the gospel. Now, in Christianity today in our country, the word obligation sounds very old-fashioned, sounds burdensome. We are living among a people that does things only if they feel like it. And I've seen that seep into the church over the years. You see that with marriage vows. If you say to someone, you obligated yourself before God to love and cherish your spouse. Yeah, but I don't feel like it anymore. It's the same thing with going to work. I'm amazed at the work ethic now, aren't you? I hear over and over from businesses, well, so-and-so just didn't show up today. Did they call in? No. They just don't show up. And you say to someone, but you obligated yourself. You signed a contract to show up to work. Oh, yeah. I don't take that seriously. The word obligation is considered somewhat silly. And you remind people that with their church membership vows. You obligated yourself. You said vows to God. Oh, yeah, but I don't feel like it. I don't feel like coming to church. And so obligation has become somewhat of an unfriendly term. But I would suggest to you that should be a very important word in your Christian vocabulary. Paul writes here, I'm obligated to unbelievers. And so are you. You are obligated to be a good example in their presence. You are obligated to be gracious, not to talk sinfully. That when you're a bad example, you apologize. In a sense, you owe them a good testimony because God has given you the gospel and to be a light that shines. And you should think about unbelievers in that term, that you're obligated before them. Woe to us if we are given a gift, but we refuse to let our lights shine. In the same way, you're obligated with the church. You're obligated to one another. Church is more than go when I feel like it. You're obligated to come hear the word. You're obligated to encourage one another, to pray for one another. Now, let me qualify this, because there's always somebody who takes something too far, because you can't qualify everything. If you wake up next Sunday with 110 fever and a splitting headache, don't say, Pastor said I'm obligated, I have to go to church. Don't be crazy. There are reasons to miss church. But the idea of duty, that we have a duty in our Christian witness, we have a duty, Christian obligations, should not be a legalistic concept because we see Paul himself using it. And so we should be willing to learn from each other. We should be obligated to each other. We should not think too much of ourselves. We see that with Paul. Remembering we are sinners that do not deserve the grace we have received. And when we think about obligation, I mean, come on. What could we give Christ in compared to what he's given us? It's not even close, right? Eternal salvation. What could we render back? Let's be real. Obligation is the least we can do. Amen.